This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Fast and Loose by Stuart Woods. Read for you by Tony Roberts. 1. Stone Barrington lay back in the cockpit of the Concordia 40, a small cruising yawl built by Abeking and Rasmussen, a German yard, in 1938, and let the light breeze take him back toward Dark Harbor. The sails were nicely balanced as he sailed up Maine's Penobscot Bay, and he lashed the helm while he looked around, then peed overboard. Thus relieved, he settled back into the cockpit and tucked a cushion behind him, relaxed and happy. He dozed off. The yacht jerked a bit, waking him, and he found himself in the thickest fog he had ever experienced. He could barely make out the stem of the boat, and he was uncertain about his course. He had been headed for the Tarratine Yacht Club moorings and his own dock beyond, but he didn't know how long he had been asleep or whether the wind had changed and put him off course. He checked the depth sounder, 55 feet of water, too deep to anchor with the rope he had aboard. He stood up and dropped the mainsail to slow the boat to a crawl, continuing with the jib and the mizzen. He went back to his cockpit seat and resumed his position, but left the helm lashed. They were making only 3 knots in the light breeze, and he reckoned he couldn't get into too much trouble at that speed. The depth was now 70 feet. He heard a voice from somewhere in the fog saying, "Start the engines and drop the sails," but he couldn't figure out the direction from which it had come. Then there was the sound of water moving past a hull, but he was still unable to determine the direction. He rummaged in a cockpit locker for the air horn and pressed the button. The noise shocked him, and it was followed by shouting from the fog. Then he saw a shape to port and grabbed for the helm. It took a moment to throw off the lashings, and in that time there was a terrible noise, and his world turned upside down. The boom swung across the cockpit and caught him on the side of his head, and darkness fell. He felt the pain before he felt his surroundings, and he feared that if he opened his eyes it might make things worse. He allowed some light past his eyelids, then quickly shut them again, groaning loudly at the pain. He heard a rustle beside him and felt a cool hand on his forehead. "He's awake," a low female voice said. "Get father." Stone tried to speak, but his mouth was too dry. A glass brushed his lips, and he took in a sip of water. "Is that better? Can you speak?"
"I'm sorry to open with a cliché," he said, "but where am I?"
She chuckled. "You're in bed. You had an accident." He got his eyes all the way open this time, and there was an arm attached to the cool hand, and a woman attached to the other end of the arm. Very blonde, almost white hair.
"What kind of an accident?"
"What's the last thing you remember?" she asked.
He thought about that. "Fog," he said. "Lots of fog. There was a noise."
"Your foghorn?"
"Yes.
That was the first we knew of your presence."
"I didn't hear yours."
"I'm sorry about that. The crew was busy getting the sails down." He struggled to sit up, but she pushed him back. "Not yet," she said. She lifted his head and tucked another pillow under it, enabling him to look around, first at the woman. Very nice. He was in a cozy cabin of beautifully varnished mahogany. "My father will be here in a moment to take a look at you," she said. "Your name is Stone Barrington, is it not?"
"It is."
"My name is Marissa Carlson, with a C and 2 S's.
"How did you know my name?"
"You had a wallet with business cards inside. It's drying out while your clothes are being laundered."
He realized he was naked under the covers. "Who undressed me?" he asked.
She laughed. "The pleasure was mine."
"I'm glad you see it that way." "Well," a man's voice said, "is our patient awake?"
he stepped into the cabin, an older male version of his daughter.
"More or less," Stone said.
"This is my father, Dr. Paul Carlson," she said.
"You had a thump on your head," the doctor said. "I noticed that."
Carlson laughed.
"He's well enough to have a sense of humor."
"Where is my boat?" Stone asked.
"I'm afraid it's at the bottom of Penobscot Bay. There was nothing we could do. It sank very quickly after the collision."
"I'm sorry to hear it. It was an old boat that had made people happy for a long time."
"What boat was it?"
"A Concordia 40 yawl, built in 1938 at Abaking and Rasmussen."
"Funny. That's where this yacht was built," the doctor said.
"What is she?"
"A 90-foot ketch, designed by Ron Holland, built the year before last."
"Well, I suppose the better yacht won the battle."
"Don't worry about your boat. We'll deal with that later. You've had a concussion, but your vital signs are strong, and you're making good conversation, so I don't think we'll have to hospitalize you. We'll get you some soup to keep your strength up, but then you must rest. You should be fine in the morning."
A uniformed steward came in with a steaming mug of something on a tray. Stone sipped it.
"Chicken soup," he said. "The cure for everything," the doctor replied. "Except my headache. Do you have any aspirin?"
"We do. Marissa?" She left the cabin and returned with three pills. Stone washed them down with the soup.
"One of them will help you sleep."
The next time he woke up, sun was streaming through the port over his head, and his clothes, laundered and ironed, were neatly stacked on the bed. He found a razor and a new toothbrush in the head, then had a hot shower and dressed. He stepped out of his cabin into a hallway and followed that to the saloon. Then he walked up some stairs to the deck and found Dr. Carlson and his daughter having breakfast on the afterdeck. They waved him to a seat, and the steward took his order.
"How are you feeling?" Carlson asked.
"Almost like new. Perhaps a little fuzzy around the edges."
"That's the last of your sleeping pill."
Stone looked around. They were anchored in the harbor, not far from the Tarantine.
"I live right over there," he said, pointing at his house. "Just down from the yacht club."
"What a lovely house," Marissa said. "Is it old?"
"Only a few years. I inherited it from a cousin, Dick Stone, who built it." "We'll get you ashore after breakfast," Carlson said, "and then we'll talk about your yacht, see what we can do."
"Are there just the two of you aboard?" Stone asked.
"Yes. My wife died some years ago," Carlson said.
"Why don't you come for dinner this evening?" Stone asked.
"Oh, that's very kind of you," Carlson said. "We'd like that very much."
"Are you Dr. Carlson of the Carlson Clinic?" Stone asked.
"I am one of the Dr. Carlsons," he replied. "The elder one. Marissa and my two sons are all Dr. Carlsons as well."
The Carlson Clinic was a famous hospital with locations in several cities, on a par with the Mayo Clinic.
"Well," Stone said, "I have not lacked for medical attention. If you say I'm all right, then I must be."
2. The tender from the big yacht dropped Stone at his dock, and he walked up to the house. The door opened, and Bob, his yellow Labrador retriever, bounded out to greet him, carrying a ratty stuffed raccoon that was his favorite toy. Stone knelt and petted him, scratched his back, then took the raccoon and tossed it into the house. Bob followed closely. Mary, his housekeeper, was dusting the living room.
"We were worried," she said, "when you didn't come home last night."
"I had an accident," Stone said.
Mary's husband, Seth Hotchkiss, came into the room.
"What kind of accident?"
"I got run down by a much larger yacht in the fog."
"Any damage?"
"Total loss. She's at the bottom of the bay."
"Such a beautiful boat," Seth said. Very sad. You all right?
A slight headache is all. By the way, there'll be two guests for dinner tonight. They're coming at 6 for drinks. Two Dr. Carlsons, father and daughter.
Lobster?
Mary asked. Just fine.
She'd boil it, shell it, and toss the meat in butter.
Mr. Rawls moved out and into his place this morning, Seth said. I drove the stuff he'd bought over there. Stone's neighbor, Ed Rawls, had had his house destroyed by fire a couple of months ago and had rebuilt. I'm happy for him, he said.
Joan called already this morning.
I'll call her back now. He sat down on the sofa and picked up the phone.
The Barrington practice at Woodman and Weld.
I'm alive.
Mary said you didn't come home last night. Anybody I know?
An accident. Collision with a much larger yacht. I lost the boat.
Oh, I'll keep my picture of it as a memento.
Anything going on?
You're still getting calls about the business with Christian St. Clair and Nelson Knott. What should I tell them?
Christian St. Clair was a multi-billionaire who had been running a TV pitchman, Nelson Knott, for president, putting lots of money behind him.
Tell them that they're both dead, and I don't speak for them. Tell them to call that guy, what's his name?
Eric Macher?
That's the one. He was St. Clair's right-hand man in all this. They should speak to him, if he hasn't been arrested.
It's been weeks. Why don't they leave you alone?
Beats me. If I talk to the media, I'll find myself in the spin zone. They'll distort whatever I say.
This morning's Times had the medical examiner's report on St. Clair. Cause of death was a bomb in a piece of luggage that he opened. Would that be your strong case?
Not my strong case. Ed Rawls's. It was taken from him at gunpoint, and he didn't have time to tell them how to open it safely.
So Ed's not to blame?
I would defend him on the available evidence.
When you coming home? You're due for your physical first of the week.
I'm dining with two eminent physicians tonight. Will that do?
It's your FAA flight physical to keep your medical certificate valid. You can't fly without it.
I know, I know. I hate to come back just for that. The weather up here is gorgeous. Autumn comes earlier here than in New York.
Lucky you. It's like a steam bath on the streets here.
No calls?
Dino called to find out when you're coming back. He couldn't reach you there.
I'll call him this morning. Nothing else?
Nope. Apparently everyone has forgotten about you.
Everyone but the bloody media. Don't give them this number or my cell number.
Gotcha.
See you later.
Stone hung up and wondered what to do next. He and his clothes were already clean, so he didn't need to bathe and dress. He called Dino.
Machete.
It's Stone.
Where the hell have you been?
I'll tell you, but you're not going to believe me.
Try me.
I was sailing late yesterday afternoon when I encountered a fog bank. Couldn't see a thing.
Let me guess. You were run down by a beautiful yacht, sailed by a beautiful woman who rescued you and nursed you back to health.
That's pretty much what happened.
You're kidding. I made that up.
You must be psychic. The owner of the yacht is Dr. Paul Carlson of the Carlson Clinic and his daughter.
What happened to your yacht?
She lies in a watery grave at the bottom of Penobscot Bay.
That's sad. Pretty boat.
Listen, can you still hijack that police helicopter whenever you like?
Whenever I like, sometimes.
Why don't you do that this afternoon and get them to drop you here? Weekend's coming up and it's nice and cool here.
Put me down for a yes. I'll check with Viv and confirm if you'll hang on for a moment.
He put Stone on hold, then came back.
I talked her into it, and the chopper's available. We'll aim for 5 o'clock.
I'll meet you at the airstrip. The Carlsons are coming to dinner. They're nice folks.
We'll look forward to it. Bye.
Dino hung up. Stone told Mary.
to order more lobsters. Stone stood by the lovely old 1938 Ford station wagon that was the house car and watched the NYPD helicopter settle onto the runway. The co-pilot got out and dumped the Bachetti's luggage onto the tarmac, then got back in and the chopper lifted off and turned southwest toward New York. Stone kissed Viv, shook Dino's hand, and the three of them loaded the bags into the wagon.
As they drove away, another helicopter, one Stone recognized from a charter service at Rockland Airport, set down on the runway.
He didn't see who got out.
"I hear Paul Carlson is coming to dinner," Viv said. "I met him at some event last year. He was charming. And he has a charming daughter, too."
"They're both coming," Stone said.
"It's about time. You've been without female companionship for too long."
"You're not going to get an argument from me about that."
3. Eric Macher marched himself into the late Christian St. Clair's library office, which was undergoing the final touches of repair, and sat down at a leather-topped library table already occupied by 4 serious-looking men.
"Good morning, gentlemen,"
Macher said, careful to speak respectfully. The 4 nodded and mumbled something. They were the chairman of the board, 2 directors, and the corporate council of St. Clair Enterprises, and Macher was there to let them know, as gently as possible, that he would be running things from now on. Their agreement was crucial to him.
"I assume you all received the documents I sent you?"
They all nodded.
"And I assume you read Mr. St. Clair's will, which was prepared by the law firm of Mr. Berenson, our corporate counsel."
"That is so," Berenson said, "and it was signed and witnessed in my presence."
The others merely nodded.
"Mr. Berenson, was I a party to drawing up the will, and did I discuss it at any time with you or any of your people?"
"No and no," Berenson replied. "I am satisfied that the will is authentic and correctly represents the wishes of Mr. St. Clair."
"Thank you," Macher said. "Do any of you have any questions about the preparation and intent of the will?"
Heads were shaken.
"Thank you."
"Mr. Macher," the chairman said, "I have a question."
"Please ask it, sir."
"What is the purpose of this meeting?"
Macher took a document from his briefcase and distributed copies to the 4 men.
"The purpose is to pass this motion, appointing me as permanent chief executive officer of St. Clair Enterprises. Do I hear a second?"
The chairman looked up from the document.
"This gives you extraordinarily broad and deep powers in the operation of the various companies, and us very little oversight."
"That is quite true," Macher said. "And that is in line with the way Mr. St. Clair ran the enterprises and wished to have them run in the event of his death, is it not, Mr. Berenson?"
Macher had met with Berenson earlier and acquired his cooperation in return for the continuation of his firm's handling of all the enterprise's legal work.
"It is entirely in line with both Mr. St. Clair's past practices and his wishes for the enterprises to continue to be operated," Berenson said.
The chairman shifted in his seat.
"It also says that the board will serve at the pleasure of the CEO and that he will appoint replacements as necessary."
"It does," Macher replied. "I would like to mention that I have no plans to change the way the board is presently made up or has operated in the past."
That caused a few wrinkles to disappear from the chairman's forehead.
"Or in the board's compensation," Macher added. He could see on their faces that that had done the trick. "I second the motion," the chairman said, "and I call for it to be passed by acclamation."
"Hear, hear," the 4 said in unison.
"Thank you for your expression of confidence, gentlemen," Macher said.
There is no further business at this time, but we will meet again in accordance with the existing schedule of board meetings. That was annually. I should tell you that, in the interests of efficiency, I shall be occupying this house and conducting business from this room when I am in New York. Since Mr. St. Clair's will left all his residences and other possessions to St. Clair Enterprises, I shall also be using them as necessary. This, of course, included the yacht, but he didn't mention it. Is there any further business, gentlemen?
There is the question of your own compensation and benefits package, the chairman said.
Mr. Berenson's firm is working on that as we speak, and he will see that you are notified when the work is complete.
That is so, Berenson said.
Then if there are no other matters before us, this meeting is concluded. Thank you for your continued work and cooperation, gentlemen.
He stood, causing them to stand as well, and after shaking hands, they filed out. Berenson, as previously agreed, remained.
Thank you, Tommy, Mocker said. I thought that went very well.
So did I, Eric.
You may now send the prepared letters to all the operating officers of the various enterprises and the general letter to all employees, including the staffs of the properties and the crews of the yacht, the helicopter, and the fleet of aircraft. I think it's important that everyone understand that, for purposes of continuity and morale, a new regime is now in place.
I agree entirely, Eric, Berenson said.
They will all go out by FedEx within the hour.
Incidentally, Tommy, you may prepare a letter from me, doubling your personal salary as counsel with immediate effect, and I will sign it upon receipt.
Thank you for that expression of your confidence, Eric.
Mocker handed him a sheet of paper.
Here is a list of all credit accounts previously available only to Christian, which should be notified that I am now the sole signatory. There is also my bank account number, to which my signing bonus and my first year's salary should be deposited, and a list of credit cards for the bank to issue to me and my secretary.
Of course, I'll see that the signing bonus is deposited today.
The signing bonus was $25 million, and Mocker's salary was $10 million, a year, plus an unlimited expense account.
Thank you, and I expect we'll talk soon.
The two men shook hands, and Berenson departed.
Mocker walked to the new desk that had replaced the previous one destroyed in the explosion and began unpacking the boxes that he had had sent from his office in D.C., which included his files and personal photographs. He placed his belongings in the appropriate drawers and arrayed the sterling silver-framed photographs on the new credenza behind him. There was a knock on the door.
Come in.
His secretary entered the room.
I saw that the board had left, she said. Is there anything I can do for you?
Are you quite comfortable in your new rooms upstairs, Hilda?
Yes, sir. They are very nice.
Your salary increase will be in effect from this day, and new credit cards have been ordered for you.
You may open an account with the company's bank today.
Thank you, Mr. Marker. I'm very pleased to be working with you in New York.
I am pleased too, Hilda.
She left, and Mocker leaned back in his new chair and placed his feet on the desk. He had never felt so good. Things could not have gone better if he had planned St. Clair's death himself.
4. Stone called Ed Rawls and invited him to dinner.
"Thanks, I could use the break," Ed replied. "Unpacking is a bitch. See you at 6. You're on."
Stone let himself into Dick Stone's secret office, behind a panel, and checked for messages and faxes. He had just come out and locked the door behind him when the front doorbell rang. He went to answer it and found a small woman wearing a headset and carrying a microphone, Behind her stood a man carrying a portable TV camera.
"Good afternoon, Mr. Barrington. I'm Tina Charles from NBC News. You're a hard man to find. We've been driving all over the island looking for your house."
"I must remember to conceal it better," Stone said.
"May I come in for a moment? I have just a few questions for you."
"You may not. I have no wish to be interviewed."
"May I point out that if you speak to me exclusively, that will greatly lessen the curiosity of other media outlets, and there are many who wish to speak with you."
"How did you get to the island?"
"The station has a helicopter. We landed right after the NYPD chopper, but we didn't have a car and lost you while we were arranging for one."
"I'll give you 5 minutes," Stone said.
The woman came in and briefly surveyed the room.
"You'll sit there," she said, pointing at a chair, "and I'll sit opposite you in the other chair."
She began moving the two chairs to positions she liked.
"Okay, Bernie?" she asked the cameraman.
"Aces," the man replied. "Light is good."
She clipped a tiny wireless microphone to Stone's shirt collar.
"Give me a level," she ordered.
Stone counted slowly to 5.
"Level is good," the cameraman said.
"And sit."
She took his wrist and towed him to the chair, and they both sat down. She took off her headset and dropped it beside the chair, then fluffed her hair with both hands and freshened her lipstick. Stone watched, increasingly bored. Then it occurred to him that he should seem alert on camera, and, if possible, engaged. He made an effort to brighten his mien.
"Now," Tina said. "Title: This is Tina Charles at the main home of Mr. Stone Barrington. We're on." She stated the date and time. "Mr. Barrington, there have been many rumors floating around about your involvement in the deaths of the billionaire Christian St. Clair and his political protege, Nelson Knott."
"Hold it right there," Stone said, raising a hand. "I had no involvement whatever in their deaths. I met them only once each."
"Let's start with Mr. St. Clair. Where did you meet him?"
"About a mile from here in that direction," he said, pointing toward the water. "He was aboard his yacht with some people, and he called and invited me and a friend to dinner. I accepted."
"Who was your friend?"
"Irrelevant. Next question."
"Did you also meet Nelson Knott on Mr. St. Clair's yacht?"
"Yes, but not until the following day. I spent one night aboard the yacht and then, at my request, was put ashore."
"Did you know at that time that Mr. Knott was going to run for president?"
"He alluded to the possibility, and he seemed very interested in extracting campaign donations from two other guests aboard."
"And who were they?"
"You'd have to ask them."
Tina was looking a bit frustrated now.
"All right, let's turn to this strongbox thing."
"It's called a strong case."
"What is it?"
"A sort of large, very secure briefcase."
"And it passed through your hands on its way to Mr. St. Clair?"
"It spent a night or two in my safe, then my client removed it to his home."
"Then how did it get to Mr. St. Clair?"
"Two gentlemen visited my client's home, pointed a gun at him, and demanded he give them the strong case or be shot. He complied."
"And did he explain that it had to be opened in a certain way or it would explode?"
"If he knew that, he was not given an opportunity to explain it. The two men left hurriedly."
"And where did the case go then?"
"Eventually to Mr. St. Clair, it would seem. I don't know how many stops it made along the way."
"And Mr. St. Clair tried to open the strong case, then it exploded?"
"I believe that was the testimony of a witness who was with him at the time."
"And that would be Mr. Eric Mocker?"
"According to the New York Times," he said. "That is my source of information. Didn't you read it?"
"Well, yes. Why did the strong case explode?"
"If you read the Times, you know what I know."
"Who owned the strong case?"
"I don't know."
"But it was in your client's possession?"
"For a brief time.
Two attempts were made to steal it, the last successful.
And who was your client?
I'm sorry. That's privileged information.
You're not being very helpful, Mr. Barrington.
Stone smiled slightly. I'm not trying to be.
Don't you think the viewing public is entitled to know everything about this event?
I'm not at all sure that they are, Stone replied. It might be best if you consulted the authority investigating the event instead of me. I'm just a bystander.
But you're a witness.
That is incorrect. I was not present when these events occurred.
Are you aware that Nelson Knott took his own life?
Again, I read it in the Times. I wasn't a witness to that, either.
All right. One last question.
Promise?
Yes. What was in the Strong case?
It was never opened in my presence.
Is it true that there was nothing inside?
No. All indications point to a bomb inside.
Well, we know that, don't we?
Then why are you asking me?
Thank you, Mr. Barrington. Now back to the studio, and cut!
She stood up.
Well, that was exasperating.
Is it usually satisfying to chase people all around the northeastern United States and ask them questions to which they don't have the answers?
Could I have a glass of water, please?
Stone went to the bar, retrieved a bottle of water, and handed it to her. Good day, he said.
May I sit down and drink it?
Certainly, but not in my house. Kindly go away. She gathered up her belongings, including her headset, and bustled out of the house, followed by her technician. Dino came down the stairs.
I heard all that from up there, he said.
Good. I'm glad I don't have to recreate the event for you.
Why are all these people wanting to interview you?
Beats me. I guess they can't think of anybody else to interview.
The doorbell rang again, and Stone got up.
Do you have your gun with you, Dino?
It's upstairs. Why?
If it's that young woman again, I'd like you to shoot her. He opened the door and found Ed Rawls standing there.
5. Rawls stepped inside. He seemed a little out of breath.
Sorry if I'm early, he said. I walked over here and it took less time than I thought.
That's fine, Ed. Come in. You know Dino.
Hi, Ed.
Evening.
He accepted a large talisker from Stone.
Have you heard the news?
What news?
Of course you haven't. What am I thinking?
Hard to tell, Ed. Spit it out.
Oh, you remember one Eric Macha?
I do.
I've had news that he has taken over Christian St. Clair's holdings, personal and business. Everything except what St. Clair left his wife.
How could he do that?
He met with the board and with the support of the corporate counsel, Thomas Berenson, who drew the will and had it witnessed. He got himself appointed CEO with power to replace board members at will. And he is heir to St. Clair's personal property that wasn't left to his wife, including the yacht.
Stone poured drinks for himself and Dino while he thought about that. Then he sat down.
I know a little about Tommy Berenson's reputation, and it isn't all good. If I were a board member, I'd put that will through the ringer.
And you'd be fired and replaced in the blink of an eye. Anyway, with Tommy Berenson backing him, he's in an impossibly strong position.
Well, Stone said, I'm glad I don't own stock in any of St. Clair's ventures.
Not even the yacht?
Well, there is that. Stone admitted.
Anyway, none of St. Clair's businesses are publicly owned. He started with a large fortune from his father and built his empire out of profits.
How do you know so much about St. Clair?
When I was in prison, it was sort of my hobby to follow the careers and lives of a number of people, Ed said. St. Clair was one of them,
and apart from the Internet, I had my own sources with good information to impart. You must be the most successful prisoner in the history of the federal system, Stone observed.
Don't you believe it?
I was just looking for information while others were establishing fortunes and others were conducting criminal enterprises. Was prison security that loose that these things could go on? You have to remember that the Atlanta Federal Prison was closed, then later reopened in a small way, to contain special prisoners and employing a very small staff. None of the inmates had histories of violence. They were mostly white-collar thieves and a few other special cons like me, who were put there to keep prisoners in other jails from killing them. A few people had cell phones and laptops, though they weren't used openly, but communication with the outside was fairly easy. I must remember if I ever commit a crime to get sent to Atlanta, Stone said.
I'll note that preference in your file, Dino said.
Stone, Rawl said, you don't seem to be getting what this means. Stone blinked. Should I be? You remember I told you that St. Clair had his own police force? I do remember. Well, Eric Marker was its chief, and he still is, except now he has complete power. He doesn't have to wait for St. Clair to tell him to remove somebody from living. He can just issue the order himself. Now, why would he do that and jeopardize his newly found position? Because he is a revenge freak, and he's going to get drunk with power very quickly. I don't think I've ever encountered anybody quite like that, Stone said. How would you define a revenge freak? Someone who, when slighted, however slightly, extracts a price from the slighter, usually one all out of proportion to the seriousness of the slight. Even unto death? Death was Marker's work when he was at the CIA. I mean, he always had a title as a cover, and he did carry out covert operations for the agency, but they usually revolved around the removal of one or more of the opposition. He was instrumental in the establishment of the agency's drone program, which has carried assassination to new and exotic heights. Yes, I've seen the pictures of the firing of Hellfire missiles through windows, exploding entire houses. Oh, now it's much more refined than that, Ed said. Now, some of them are equipped with silenced 50-caliber sniper rifles that can remotely put a round into the ear of an opponent and not make a sound heard on the ground. Heads just suddenly explode, alarming others nearby. Please tell me that St. Clair did not have a fleet of those standing by. Not a fleet, but Marker, through his connections with agency suppliers, managed to corral a couple. But I digress. I don't mean necessarily that Marker is going to hunt any of us down with drones. I'm relieved to hear it, and I'm glad that I hardly ever came to Marker's attention. Don't you believe it? Rawl said. Huh? St. Clair knew everything about you and me that could be known, and it was Marker who gathered the intelligence on us and anyone else St. Clair dealt with. He was an information freak. He had to know everything about everybody. Then he would have known he was backing a political candidate, Nelson Knott, who had a proclivity for raping and sometimes impregnating women who worked for him. Of course he did. And he took the greatest precautions to see that that news never came out. He took the view that if there was no evidence and no witnesses, it never happened. But his precautions were not successful. Right. You managed to hide one of the women and her family at your home in England, and that recording she made blew the lid off Knott's candidacy, and incidentally, off the candidate as well. How colorfully you put it. That's the sort of interference that Marker would take personally. Oh, he's thin-skinned, is he?
thin-skinned and hard-shelled. Simultaneously. You must remember that most of the work St. Clair put into creating Knot as a candidate was actually performed by Mocker and his wide-ranging P.D. Stone took a swig of his bourbon and let it find its way down. "Oh, shit," he said.
6. The Carlsons, father and daughter, arrived on time for drinks, and after Stone had served everybody, Dr. Paul handed Stone a brown envelope.
"What's this?" Stone asked.
"Some photographs. Take a look at them."
Stone opened the envelope and removed half a dozen color photographs of a Concordia 40.
"This is gorgeous," Stone said. "Better equipped and newer looking than mine."
"It was one of the original Concordias, the ones built in Germany like yours," Carlson said. "Would you consider it an adequate replacement for your yacht?"
"More than adequate," Stone said. "Superior, I would say."
"Then if you will accept it as a fair replacement, it's yours, and I will deal with my insurance company for the cost."
"Then I accept."
"Where is she?"
"She's out of the water in Rockland, but ready to launch
after an extensive refit. One of my crew knew somebody who knew somebody, and there she was. She'll be at your dock tomorrow."
"You take my breath away," Stone said, handing them to Dino to see. "We very nearly took your breath away, permanently, and I'm relieved that you like the replacement Concordia."
Ed Rawls looked at the photos and raised his glass.
"To new old boats," he said,
and everybody drank. Over dinner, Paul Carlson was very quiet, and his daughter noticed.
"Dad, is something wrong?"
"Not wrong, exactly," Carlson said. "Just a little worrying."
"Anything an attorney and a policeman and a retired spy can help with?" Stone asked.
"I don't think so. It's a business thing."
"The Carlson Clinic is your family business, isn't it?"
Dino asked.
"Yes, it is."
"The city sent me there for my last physical."
"I hope it was performed to your satisfaction."
"Well, the city was satisfied, and that's all I cared about."
Carlson sighed.
"I'm not sure it will be the same clinic this time next year."
"Oh, Dad," Marissa said, "this isn't about that thing with that man St. Clair, is it?"
"Yes, it is."
"But he died. Surely he's not a problem anymore."
"May I ask," Stone said, "are you referring to Christian St. Clair?"
"I am," Carlson replied. "Shortly before his death, he made a takeover offer for the Carlson Clinics. I, my daughter, and my two sons own 40% of the stock, but over the years we've awarded shares to many of our employees, mostly doctors and nurses, who were valuable to our work. They've formed an association, and St. Clair made an offer, an inadequate one, which was apparently his practice, for the stock held by the association members."
"Did they accept?"
"They voted to accept in principle, dependent on a much better offer. Selling their shares would make many of them wealthy, some of them very wealthy. So the prospect is tempting to them. And now I've heard that St. Clair's business interests will be run by a man named Mocker, who apparently has a reputation that is something less than savory."
"Who is representing you in this matter?"
"We have a competent firm who represents us in our normal operations and who has defended us in malpractice matters, though very few of them, but I don't believe they are equipped to take on this challenge. And we're faced with a deadline. St. Clair's offer is to expire in about 3 weeks."
"I see," Stone replied.
"If I can be of help, please let me know."
That was as far as he was prepared to go, without encouragement from Carlson.
"Well, Dr. Carlson," Dino said,
since this transaction involves a hospital, you should know that our friend Stone is a well-known ambulance chaser, and very good at it.
Thank you for your confidence, Dino, Stone said wryly, but I'm sure Dr. Carlson can address his problem without it.
I confess that the matter crossed my mind when I saw your business card while we were drying you out. And drying out is one of the things Stone does best, Dino said.
Everyone laughed.
Sorry, bad joke, but I couldn't resist.
I've heard of Woodman and Weld, Carlson said. And after making a few calls to friends more knowledgeable than I in these matters, I must say I am impressed with what I've heard. Would your firm consider taking us on, Stone?
I think we'd both benefit from sobriety before going into that, Dr. Carlson, and we have taken drink this evening. May we discuss it tomorrow, in the cold light of day?
Of course.
I will say that I'm optimistic that we can find a solution to your problem.
Thank you. I feel better already.
After coffee, the Carlsons excused themselves, and Stone walked them down to his dock, where their launch awaited. Carlson extended his hand.
Thank you for dinner, Stone, and I'll look forward to seeing you tomorrow.
Would 10 o'clock here be convenient, Dr. Carlson?
Certainly, and you must call me Paul. Everyone but my children does.
Of course, Paul. See you tomorrow.
He waved them off, then walked back to the house. Dino and Ed Rawls had disappeared. Stone sat down and made a phone call to Arthur Steele, chairman and CEO of the Steele Insurance Group, a client and on whose board he sat.
Good evening, Stone. Is everything all right?
I'm sorry to call so late, Art, but something has come up that I think might be of interest to you, and there are time constraints, so I thought I shouldn't wait until tomorrow.
Well, that's quite all right. How can I be of help?
Stone told him about being run down by the Carlson's yacht.
Paul Carlson and his daughter came to dinner tonight, and he told me that Christian St. Clair, before his death, had made an offer for the Carlson Clinics, an association of stockholders who are current and former employees own 60% of the company, and apparently many of them are willing to cash out.
I see,
Steele said, and since it's St. Clair, I'm sure the offer was inadequate.
That was my view as well. Perhaps you've heard that St. Clair's enterprises are now in the hands of one Eric Mocker.
That came in on the grapevine this afternoon. What I know of him isn't good.
What would you think of the Carlson Clinic as an investment?
I've had many dealings with the Carlsons over the years, and I can tell you that it is a very well-run company, both medically and business-wise.
I had thought that the case.
Would you like me to investigate putting together a counteroffer for the clinic?
I think Paul Carlson might be receptive to that, if he could be assured of his family continuing to operate as they have in the past.
Certainly. I think the family is one of the clinic's greatest assets. They are very profitable and operate with little or no debt, and they own the real estate on which their branches sit.
I'm meeting with Carlson tomorrow morning, and I'll pass on your interest and ask him for the documentation you'll need to put together an offer.
Does the St. Clair bid have a deadline?
It does. It expires in 3 weeks.
Then we'll want to see that the association knows that a better offer is in the wings. We don't want them to cave in while we're thinking about it.
Good. Also, as you know, I sit on the board of Strategic Services, Mike Freeman's security company, so I know that Mike is interested in acquisitions.
Mike would make an excellent partner.
I'm glad you think so.
Very good, Stone. Get back to me at the office after you and Carlson have talked further.
I'll do that. Good night, Art.
Good night.
Dino came into the house.
I drove Ed home, he said. He was a little worse for the wear, and it's a dark night.
Thank you, Dino.
I'll bet you've already called Art Steele,
Dino said. Ah, you know me too well. And thank you so much for those remarks about ambulance chasing and drying out.
Any time, pal. Any time.
7. The following morning, Stone called his old friend Bill Eggers, who was the managing partner of Woodman and Weld.
"Where are you?" Eggers asked.
"In Maine."
"It's very hot here."
"It's very cool in Maine."
Eggers made a groaning noise.
"Bill, I've recently met Dr. Paul Carlson."
"Of the Carlson Clinic?"
"The same."
Stone explained the circumstances of the clinic's ownership and the offer from St. Clair Enterprises.
"Paul has asked me if the firm would represent him in dealing with this matter."
"Of course we would. I'd be delighted to add the Carlson Clinic to our client roster."
"I'm glad to hear it. I have another meeting with Paul this morning at 10, and I think it might be a good idea if you would email me a representation contract for him to sign and a fee schedule."
"Certainly.
Have you heard about Eric Mockers taking over at St. Clair?"
"Yes, and I was stunned. Christian was a very elegant fellow, if ethically challenged at times, but Mocker is a thug, by all accounts."
"He has Tommy Berenson on his side, and from what I hear, Berenson drew and witnessed the will."
"And I'm sure he was paid very handsomely to do so."
"Who would you have expected to succeed St. Clair in the event of his death?"
"I should have thought one of his division heads, or a CEO at one of his companies."
"Not Mocker?"
"I'm sure Christian found him very useful, but not presentable. If this takeover bid should turn into a fight, you should expect him to fight dirty."
"I'll keep that in mind."
"I'll have my secretary email you those documents immediately."
"Thanks, Bill."
Stone hung up and made some notes to himself for his meeting with Carlson. Dino came down to breakfast and ordered bacon and eggs.
"Dino, could you run a check on Eric Mocker for me?" Stone asked.
"Sure. What do you expect to find?"
"I have no expectations. I just want to know what there is."
Dino made the call to his assistant, then hung up.
"A few minutes," he said.
Stone had a thought. He called Billy Barnett, who worked as a producer in Stone's son Peter's film production company at Centurion Studios in L.A. Billy had once been known as Teddy Fay and had been a 20-year employee of the CIA, rising to deputy head of the Technical Services Division, which equipped intelligence operatives for their missions.
"Stone, how are you?"
"Very well, Billy. And you?"
"Couldn't be better. What can I do for you?"
"I'm just looking for information about somebody who was a covert operative at the agency. His time there should have overlapped yours."
"And who would that be?"
"One Eric Mocker." Stone spelled it for him.
"Sure, I knew him. I probably outfitted him for a dozen or more missions."
"What was your general impression of him?"
"The man was an assassin." "Oh, he was a good officer overall and had a successful career at the agency, but he had the reputation of being too ready to kill at the drop of a hat. I wouldn't want to meet him in a dark alley."
"Anything else?"
"Very bright and adaptable. If one thing didn't work, he'd find another way."
"I think management was always a little leery of him."
"That's very interesting," Stone said. "Thank you, Billy. Are you having dealings with Mocker, Stone?"
"I expect I will be,"
Stone explained the situation.
"I see. May I make a suggestion?"
"Of course."
"Will you be having face-to-face meetings with him?"
"Possibly. Certainly someone on our side will."
"I think that it might be a good idea for me to attend a meeting or two with him, not to say anything, just to let him know that I'm involved with his opposition. It might make him more careful in his dealings with you. I expect to be in New York for a few days soon." That sounds like a very good idea. I'd be interested in your assessment of the man. Let me know when you'd like me to be there. I can arrange my schedule accordingly. I'll do that, Billy. How are my boys doing out there?
He referred to Peter and to Dino Bichetti's son, Ben, who was head of production at the studio.
Thriving, Billy said. You'd be proud. Well, I have to run. I'll speak to you soon. They said goodbye and hung up.
Paul and Marissa Carlson arrived, and they sat down at the dining table to talk. Stone presented the representation agreement and the fee schedule.
Look these over and have anyone else you rely on for advice do so too. And keep a copy for your records. I'd be happy to go through them with you.
This morning, Carlson said, I spoke to Dr. Willie Keeling, who is representing the Stockholders Association in the negotiations. I let him know that there would likely be a better offer coming and not to do anything rash. He said he'd check with me before taking any further action.
Good idea, Stone said. We wouldn't want them to rush into anything. Paul, I believe you know Arthur Steele at Steele Insurance Group.
Of course. We've met a number of times. Good man.
Art would like to put together an offer from Steele Insurance Group for the association's stock, and he, as well as people from our firm, would like to go to your head office in New York and be taken through the clinic's operations and to collect the necessary supporting documentation.
Certainly. My youngest son, Niels, is the chief financial officer of the company, and I'll instruct him to give them whatever they need.
When would they visit?
Tomorrow morning.
There may also be some people along from a security company called Strategic Services who may be participating in the deal.
I know of them. I'll have our head of security meet with them, and my elder son, Sven, who is chief operating officer, will be available to meet with whomever you wish.
What is your position at the clinic? Stone asked.
I am chief executive officer and chief of medicine. Marissa is my deputy chief of medicine.
Tell me, Stone, how is your health?
Very good, thanks. I'm due for my biennial FAA medical exam next week. Well, Marissa is a designated medical examiner for the FAA, in addition to being a pilot. She could administer the exam, if you wish.
What a good idea, Stone said. I'll make an appointment.
You know the drill about filling out the application online before your visit? Marissa asked.
I do.
She handed him a card. You may list me as your examiner on the form. They talked for a few more minutes, then the Carlsons stood to go.
Your new yacht will be delivered this afternoon, Carlson said. I'm informed that it was launched this morning and is being sailed over here. I'll look for it.
And I'll look for you next week.